Welcome to the World Bank EdTech Podcast, a conversation on the use of technology and innovation in education globally. My name is Bob Hawkins, and I'm the Global Lead for Technology and Innovation in Education here at the World Bank. We are very pleased to have with us today Pramod Varma, the CTO of the XStep Foundation. Welcome, Pramod. It's been a while since we've been able to connect with each other.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here, Bob. It's been a while and looking forward to the conversation.
So Pramod, I'm excited about our conversation today. We met a number of years back as you were just starting the XStep and Sunbird journey. And as of late, we've been working with a number of countries on updating their EdTech policies, strategies, and action plans as a response to COVID to look at ways in which to make education systems much more resilient and future ready. And the concept of digital public infrastructure is coming into a number of these policies and strategies. So today I'm excited to kind of explore your journey with XStep and Sunbird around this theme of digital public infrastructure. And I'm wondering if we can just start the conversation with you sharing a little bit about what is XStep, what is Sunbird, how you've used Sunbird to create Diksha in India, and exactly how do you define digital public infrastructure? Pramod.
Great topics to start with. Let's sort of go back in time a little bit. As you may know, some of us began our now called digital public infrastructure. Then there was no particular terminology per se with our identity project. And India's identity project and subsequently payment, you know, the UPI, unified payment, as part of some of that journey, architecting them at a billion people scale, took us to some interesting playbooks, in one sense, thinking about how to address societal problems at scale. And we were convinced that no single entity or no single government can actually solve multidimensionally complex problems like education or healthcare or even now climate. You know, it's much bigger discussion that's going on. So our thesis was that we need to be able to create building blocks, digital building blocks like the GPS, you know, or internet protocols and so on, that allows innovators, including government and private sector, public sector, all to innovate on top of it, thus creating very large number of solution possibilities and evolve as the future is unknown. And so we need an evolvable framework for us to be able to navigate the unknown future. So this playbook started pretty much coming together well in our mind. That's when, in 2015, decide to create the XStep Foundation. Ek in Hindi means one step, as an English word, step. So one step at a time, the transformation, societal transformation, we believe are never leapfrogged. It looked like leapfrogged 10 years later, but it always one step at a time, but at scale, not in silos. So we appropriately, in one sense, named XStep Foundation. We were solely focused on school education at that time in the first 5 years. And we put ourselves a very, very large goal of reaching 200 million children through the digital public infrastructure approach. And a small foundation like us cannot alone reach 200 million. 200 million is nearly the up to mid school student population of India. So it's a very large number. Most efforts are 1 million, 10 million, you know, maybe even 15, 20 million. Nobody has reached 200. That's like a 10x plus growth, right, in terms of reaching. And we were very clear, unless we put that number, we will continue to do yet another NGO, right? Yet another NGO trying to build yet another app, trying to solve education. Nothing wrong about it, but we were very focused on at scale solving. So we decided we will not build applications and so on. We rather build a digital backbone for education in India. And that's when we started the journey with the Ministry of Education and education is a concurrent subject between center and states. States have a lot of autonomy in India, so quite a lot of diversity in our education system. So we worked with a federal set of actors from Ministry of Education to state education to many, many NGOs who are building content, creating programs on the ground. They actually run programs on the ground.
And how many NGOs are now part of the XSTEP ecosystem? Is it the XSTEP ecosystem or the Diksha ecosystem?
Yeah, so it's a bit of both. Because we are a foundation, we continue to facilitate very large ecosystem, probably a few hundred NGOs in variety of different roles are part of the XSTEP Sunbird ecosystem. So we called the digital public goods because we were a foundation. We built everything as open source digital public goods, and we put it out on GitHub. And literally, first thing we did is to put out everything we were building, and that's called Sunbird. Sunbird.org explains many of those digital building blocks that we built during this journey. And Diksha was the name of the digital public infrastructure built out of Sunbird in India. Multi-tenanted infrastructure that allowed many states and education boards to become and autonomously use that infrastructure to build many of the solutions that they were looking for. And then we activated many NGOs around it, many ecosystem players around it. And Diksha went from early 2017 to us launched. And by 2022, we were actually 200 million children reach about 10 million teachers as well. So it was tremendous adoption of Diksha, truly as an infrastructure, allowing many others to build solutions around it. And it's still a journey. It's still a journey. Education is never ending. It's a lifelong journey, continuously enhancing it, continuously allowing states to create newer programs, post-COVID issues, and so on. So interesting journey.
It's the magic and challenge of technology. It's constantly evolving.
Indeed.
So when we talk about digital public infrastructure, many people immediately think of connectivity, data centers, cloud services, kind of the physical infrastructure.
Yeah.
But in this case, we're really talking about software.
Correct.
And what makes your approach to software development different from prior attempts to create open source software? I mean, there's a long history of open educational resources. What were the challenges with prior open interoperable software development, and how did you address these challenges?
Yeah, excellent question, actually. So let me define DPI first, digital public infrastructure. So digital public infrastructure, quite like the connectivity and computing infrastructure, cloud. Even if you look at today's cloud infrastructure, you will see higher order building blocks like database as a service or analytics as a service, and you know, many other interesting, like AI today is available as service, right? Like optical character recognition. If you want to scan something on a handwritten thing, you have an API. So private players have shown that you can create higher order APIs, application programming interfaces, or services in general, that are by itself is not a solution. Just building blocks, that ingredients into someone else's recipe and someone else's final solution that they would put together. Exactly same way, except that the public in DPI stands for not public owned necessarily, but public interest. So the definition around the G20, World Bank was key partner to India in that journey. When we defined DPI, the P was much debated, and it sort of eventually they agreed that P is mostly public interest. So I think the difference is that brings its own better open, transparent governance and other asks like that. But nevertheless, it's very similar to what private cloud vendors or private technology providers like Google, AWS, all have shown that by building reusable services, not solutions, ingredients itself, it allows someone else to rapidly assemble a solution rather than building from scratch. And that dramatically reduces the cost of innovation, cost of experimentation, cost of trying out various things, and a cost for many NGOs and typically fragmented environments in education, as you see. They don't have $1 billion capital to everyone to do the whole thing, full stack in one sense. So DPI is exactly the same approach, taking beyond the communication and computing to higher order digital services, identity as a service, payment delivery as a service, content curation as a service, telemetry and observability as a service, and many, many things like that, including Indic languages in India. Language is a big deal. So we are building a lot of building blocks that are services to build voice-based interfaces very quickly. But except that these services are deployed more like a utility, public utility, rather than a private for-profit environment. India's DPI journey in education, for example, Diksha on Beyond right now, are actually built as a set of ingredients exposed via a set of APIs, application programming interfaces, for the ecosystem to build solutions that are rapidly built and actually try out. And for India, this is key because of our scale and diversity. Because you can sort of try one app for the country, but our diversity, language diversity, economic diversity, education diversity, societal diversity at large, is so phenomenal in one sense. It calls for nothing other than this approach for us to be able to reduce the cost of innovation at the end of the day, right?
So to clarify for our listeners, XStep is the foundation that launched this initiative and manages kind of a broad ecosystem across India. Sunbird is the open platform that is composed of building blocks, that is composed of a number of what are called microservices to provide educational services from content to assessment. And then Diksha is the instance of Sunbird that was specifically designed and configured and deployed for India. Is that a correct way of looking at it, Pramod?
So that's very well put. Very well clarified. XStep is foundation. Sunbird is a set of open source. I won't call it platform, just a nuance. It's just open source assets lying on GitHub, which is open source repository. By itself, it doesn't do anything, but someone has to take it, use it, combine with other ingredients and create their own versions of it. And Diksha is one such. You're right. Absolutely well put. So what's the difference between open source building block like Linux and so on with DPI? Actually, they are orthogonal. Just to clarify, DPI is actual runtime manifestation of digital infrastructure in a country. It's like electricity grid. But the components that go into the DPI can be proprietary or open source. But in the case of India, the Sunbird provided, quite like Linux or quite like any other open source on GitHub, we provided all the software components, building blocks as open source. But when you install it, configure it, a set of combinations of Sunbird building block, you get a DPI. And that's what Diksha is. So Diksha is an instance of many of the Sunbird building blocks coming together for India, for us to be able to use it. Some other country can take Sunbird and build their own recipe and their own DPI, even combining with other things, other open source or proprietary components.
So this is a bit of a mindset change.
Yes.
You often kind of refer to these services as Lego blocks that are interoperable and can create completely new services. And the concept of microservices is an architecture that's used in many organizations, including Amazon. I was looking at your website. At one point, there were 180 some odd microservices that were available through Sunbird. And I've noticed now that you've kind of compiled them into 19 building blocks. And are these building blocks what you have found is the most common combinations of services to solve a problem? Is that the way that you've kind of evolved?
Correct. Very, actually, extremely well put. Yeah. So we were looking at what are the common ingredients that would allow the system to build education solutions, teacher solutions, solution to administer the education system, and many, many, in diverse scenarios. So we were looking at common ingredients, and these building blocks are a set of common ingredients, with each of them exposing its own capabilities via APIs or services, microservices within it, right? So we have 180, 200 microservices, but composed into many reusable building blocks.
And Pramod, can you give us an example of one of these building blocks and how it's been deployed in a typical state or even down to the school level?
Excellent. Yeah. So one of them is, you know, the most popular one that is used in digital public infrastructure is the content services. So content, what's called a knowledge services. So there's a building block called Sunbird Knowledge that's deployed within Diksha, exposing many content related services, which means creation, updation, curation, tagging, taxonomy knowledge services. So you can create taxonomies all via APIs, right? It's not a solution to say this is how you should create. These are the possibilities that if you want to create your own taxonomy and your own tagging structure, feel free to do so. But you don't have to write the underlying tagging infrastructure all over again, right? It makes no sense. So the variety of content types like videos, audios, HTML, interactive content can be created. So there are many higher order services like that embedded, very popular, and is used today. We have, I think, 1,200 to 300,000 content pieces and several thousand courses in a particular journey. Courses create the learning journey, and content are atomic pieces of the puzzle, and that's available in it. And interestingly, how state using it, states can create their own content. Not only they can create, but co-create another building block, and that allows a more crowdsourced content services, which is why a lot of NGOs are participating in donating, supporting their content into the system. So these are all actually APIs, but Sunbird also comes with the default set of user interfaces. Default, I call it default because you can actually create your own user interfaces on top of it. And today some NGOs are building accessible apps for children with disabilities, because the same app doesn't cut for everybody, and making one app super app is a very bad way of trying to achieve it. So we believe many special purpose apps can be built, but because these ingredients are available, it's in a jiffy, literally over a week you can literally build an app. It's very powerful.
One of the interesting parts, you mentioned that this both can be used in the public sector, can be used with NGOs, as well as the private sector. And we think of services, there's oftentimes payment for services. How has the private sector participation in Sunbird and Diksha evolved in India? I know at one point when we were discussing the opportunities to engage a broader ecosystem of solution providers, this type of architecture was very attractive to support ministries of education to be able to have much more flexibility and modularity in their procurement of various systems without having to take a huge risk on a full stack procurement, which is in many cases the challenge that we face across a number of countries where we have 80 some odd different systems that don't talk to each other. I was just looking through a strategy paper the other day. There's e-learning and collaborative systems, discipline management systems, special needs systems, assessment systems, teaching and learning systems, certification and qualification systems, career planning systems, teacher information management systems, et cetera, et cetera. You get the point. And all of these systems are siloed, some in different parts of the Ministry of Education, some in different parts of the government, some in private sector partners. So it's a very fragmented set of data systems that don't talk to each other. And moreover, it's very difficult for private providers to kind of break into the system. So one of the promises and real areas of interest of what has been architected with Sunbird is the possibility to procure smaller scale systems that are managed by potentially private providers, could be in the NGO community, that could be procured at a low cost and moved out of the system if there is an uptake or if you want to replace it, which kind of avoids this challenge that we face in many countries of technology lock. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the journey with the private sector and the modularity of these systems and whether you have kind of seen any issues around sustainability or payment for these services in your experience with Sunbird and Diksha?
Yeah, excellent question. I think This is precisely why we believe digital public infrastructure is a very different way of thinking. It's not about government trying to do everything through a capital-intensive procurement and then doing it all in silos, as you said, like 80-odd systems. Everyone is procured, everyone is running, and then they're all running in a silo. So the DPI approach of interoperable building blocks that allow both private and public innovation is a way of thinking, and that's itself is different, and it might take a little bit of time. But on your larger question, how is it played out in India? The four types of usage private sector engaged in. Number one, building off Sunbird itself. That means many private sector participants are part of the open source community, building and contributing code, extensions, software code, best practices, including content, and many other parts of it coming in, right? Number two, connected to the first one, is that now we see private sector, private companies building edtech solutions, because Sunbird is not necessarily edtech. It's just an ingredient, and you can use the same ingredient to actually build very interesting scholarship services or interesting way to catalog jobs, internships, and so on. Because it's not just for education content. It is a very generalized ingredient. So people are using that to build private sector, for-profit services. And why is it interesting? When private sector start using the open source, they also contribute back. And now incentives are aligned for them to also keep the open source community alive. That's a very good thing. Otherwise, one foundation just pushing an open source community is not an open source community. You need a much larger community. You need longer sustainability mechanism beyond pumping money into keeping the open source code. So the private sector using Sunbird is the second one, which adds to the first one, which is means getting the open source supply side strong. Now come to the Diksha side. When Sunbird gets instantiated like Diksha, very interesting possibilities emerge. Now, third part of the private sector is private sector providing hosting and other offerings that allow government shift from a CapEx procurement to an OpEx procurement. Today, AWS, Azure, or even other vendors are actually part of the Sunbird ecosystem. They want to take Sunbird global, make it easier to host it. Advantage of that is that you can run it on private cloud or public cloud or a combination thereof. But the real shift is, can we shift from heavy procurement, CapEx, to an OpEx? That means pay for outcome, right? If 200,000 students are used, or 100,000 teachers are using this platform, pay for that subscription rather than paying several million and no project comes out. So it's very important to shift into an OPEX mode in many, many countries. And these private ecosystems such as cloud service provider, SaaS, software as service providers in the Sunbird ecosystem are making that offering to the world, by the way. And the fourth one, most important one, directly connects to our digital public infrastructure thinking, is that once you instantiate Diksha-like system or Diksha in India, the private sector can create completely new edtech apps now using the same APIs that are now available to start creating solutions so that government doesn't have to build all the solution. Think of this like our unified payment interface. We have Google Pay. We have Amazon Pay. We have all of them playing into a common interoperable payment rail called UPI in India. And that's why we went from 0 to 10 billion transactions in 5 years. Because many, many private sectors are incentivized to offer innovative solutions on top of the infrastructure. So this is a fourth layer, innovation layer by the private sector. So private sector is very, very key for us, both for supply sustainability, support for OPEX and hosting kind of support, and most importantly, innovation. Because if government has to do everything from top to down, procure everything, CapEx heavy, and then try to build applications and try to keep every content, never going to work. At least for India, it never works.
Now, this is the huge promise of how can you use this architecture, this infrastructure to incentivize, inspire, motivate solution providers across the ecosystem.
Indeed.
And this issue that you highlight around the opportunities to move towards OPEX, or what we look at the World Bank quite a bit is, payment for results, where, you know, in the world of technology, it should be easier to be able to capture those results in real time and then trigger a payment based on those results to kind of move the risk away from the public sector towards the private sector to be able to deliver those results. So, for instance, if you have adaptive learning software like MindSpark in India, that you could do a contract to pay them if they were able to bring X number of seventh graders up to seventh grade math level, as an example.
Absolutely.
So I want to get back to X step. So one step, and I want to talk a little bit about kind of what is the first step that countries could take. We worked together back in 2019, brought a couple countries, Peru and Costa Rica, to India to kind of learn about the experience and with the idea of them coming back and implementing it. But there were a host of challenges to the implementation of Sunbird, of microservices architecture, from capacity to mindset, to political, to the issue of legacy systems. So if you take a country that, you know, has this incredible set of fragmented systems that I discussed before, is maybe using Moodle as their learning management system, the teachers have begun to use WhatsApp, how do you begin to implement? What is the first step, the X step, to begin to implement this more open, modular, interoperable system that we've been talking about is a digital public infrastructure?
The two parts, right? Two things have happened since, you know, we did our exercise of bringing few countries to India, just to learn from each other and trying to create their own infrastructure in their own country. One, I think the COVID and the post-COVID urgency has fully kicked in terms of how digital can truly bridge the gap and, more importantly, create resilience. Second, connectivity and smartphone and everything is continuously improving. There's no going back on that anyway. And digital public infrastructure efforts across countries participating in G20 efforts, creating a shared vocabulary of something called DPI. Even we didn't call it as DPI. And everybody's been doing it. Sunbird has a much now global effort going on in terms of cloud service providers and larger system integrators and consulting for organizations, make it available easily for countries to pilot it at least.
You know, certainly, Pramod, COVID was an inflection point in countries all over the world looking at ways in which to leverage those investments made in technology to provide continuity of education services, to now think about how they can use technology to create a much more resilient education system, to not only prepare for future pandemics, future potential climate disasters that would keep students out of school, but also to address the very large out-of-school youth population and the increasing demands on education for lifelong learning. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about kind of your own experience with what you see as some of the challenges to extending digital public infrastructure constraints, as well as some of the opportunities in the coming years.
Yeah. So, Bob, I think definitely the post-COVID push for digitization, acceleration of connectivity, smartphone availability, in general, digital. You know, every year we pass through, digital is getting thicker and thicker into the society. So I think that a lot has changed and a lot more openness in doing it. But the way of thinking, digital public infrastructure, is somewhat new. And we also have another effort now began with the Center for DPI, Center for Digital Public Infrastructure, that's helping, currently engaged with about 25 countries or so in variety of ways to help them think through an architecture and design what it means to create DPIs. So DPI in education is also an important element for countries to think about and still allow them to navigate one step at a time. So one of the things we focus on is to help countries create a basic blueprint on education. And we have done that for G2P, now doing it for health and agriculture. And maybe we should do that for help countries to create a shared blueprint. What does a blueprint contain? A set of core building blocks that would act as an accelerator in the digital journey. It's not by itself solutions, as we discussed earlier. It's by just a blueprint of building blocks or DPI building blocks that accelerates their journey. Typically, things like discovery of good content, discovery of opportunities, discovery of scholarships, and discovery of funding. And these for youth, for example, youth skilling. These are all standard problems. So we need an infrastructure that allows easy discovery and fulfillment thereof, access thereof, of content, learning resources, mentorship and teaching sort of resources, internship and apprenticeship opportunities, and other funding and access to capital in scholarships and so on. So India is looking at this actively beyond Diksha to create such open infrastructure, and such blueprints can be created. Once you create the blueprint for the country, doesn't mean they have to execute on the blueprint fully. It's like building a large new city. You have the blueprint, doesn't mean it gets built overnight. But you can start building on the key, most compelling use cases that are more relevant to that country. In Brazil, for example, right now, we are engaged in creating youth skilling and livelihood open network. Different countries want different priorities. But nevertheless, without a blueprint, you don't know where you're going. What are those interoperable core building block? Credentialing, youth education credentialing is a critical block. Identities are a critical block, even in the education sector. School identity, teacher identity, and so on are very, very key for trust. Credentialing is a key for trust and portability of their skills and education work. So if you actually put distill together, you'll end up with maybe 10, 15 building blocks that ought to be there for any large-scale education transformation. And that's what becomes a blueprint. And among that, you can say, okay, I am after youth because that's my priority, versus, oh, no, I'm after early childhood, or I'm after teacher capacity. Depending on their priority, they can pick up and prioritize what they want to do. But having a direction, having a map.
So this concept of an open network for youth skilling is extremely interesting. And we've also had some discussions with both the federal ministry in Brazil, as well as the state ministries, as well as the Lehman Foundation, and also working across a number of African countries looking at how to support the development of digital skills. How would you advise a country that is maybe looking at a competency framework and wants to use maybe Digicomp to define kind of the skills they want? They have then identified maybe a number of tasks or activities that are maybe in an OER, an open education repository, that are already available that match those skills. They have begun to kind of develop some rubrics that they have for measuring those skills, whether it's expert assessment or a peer assessment or maybe some computer measures. And they want to take maybe these three initial building blocks with content they already have and create a digital public infrastructure. Maybe this is where they start. How would they take this information and actually begin to engage with this kind of open network movement for youth skilling to contribute their resources to this movement?
That's very, very concrete, and good to discuss that concrete aspect. So in this case, one would definitely think about making available resources, which are competency graph, for example, represented in a, machine readable structure, because competency lying in 50 or 150 page PDF becomes less reusable than competencies as codified, machine readable, but embeddable in other solutions. So your first question, DPIs ought to become embeddable into other systems. They are not by itself solutions, right? So you have to keep that in mind all the time. So how do you make that embeddability? By digitizing competencies, digitizing existing content resources, for example, they might have, and making it available on a network to be able to discover. So you actually attach yourself to an existing network and say, here, I'm exposing my competency framework as APIs and content catalog as APIs, right? So that way, anyone can discover it, embed it. Second, create a policy. policy that allows others to build content to use these APIs. A lot of times government want to do everything themselves. So they would not even open up the policy for private sector because they think, oh, private sector is for profit, they'll do something else and we will do our own things, right? So this silo has to be removed. DPI thinking fundamentally has to remove the silos and say exposing, saying here are the APIs, here are the policy for accessing APIs. And now ask the third question. How do I create market make? How do I create a playground for people to actually leverage what I put out? Why should anybody leverage? Why should a private company? So real question in the DPI world is you have to ask is how do we incentive align the ecosystem to leverage what I put out and innovate and contribute back to more pooled resources and actually further create skilling opportunities for the youth. Imagine a future where I am the blue dot as an individual and in the Google map, quite like we ask restaurants near me, I can ask jobs near me or apprenticeship opportunities near me. That would be a lovely way to reimagine DPI-based network rather than one more app, you download my app, come to my portal. Nobody comes to your portal, right? It's very hard. But so make it digital, expose it on a network, create policies for reuse and leverage of that, and create ecosystem programs that brings everybody on the network, a network effect or internet-like effect.
So a proposal for you, Pramod. We run what's called a EdTech Policy Academy, which has been focused very much on working with countries to solve concrete problems in their education programs that involve some sort of EdTech. And it's usually a three-week course that helps policymakers and technocrats in administrative education to really either design or implement a component. It could be a curriculum for digital skills for teachers or rethinking their EMIS system or developing a content repository. What would be fascinating would be to move this to the technical level to see if we can bring a few countries on board that maybe you've been working with, such as Brazil and others, that are looking at digital public infrastructure and develop a very hands-on course, maybe longer, maybe a two-month engagement in which they kind of develop some of these components and modules and solutions around the challenge of skilling. So maybe we can kind of explore that offline after the conversation.
Absolutely. That'll be fascinating. I think, again, here, real success would come from bringing complementary expertise. World Bank has deep expertise. We have funding agencies beyond who are also working on it. Lehman Foundation, you talked about. Local foundations who are deeply entrenched. And of course, some of the government actors and policymakers who can support it. And then we have CDPI, where I co-chair Center for DPI. We could participate. And Exeter Foundation, of course, is deeply committed to this as well. So, definitely a possibility for us to be able to do it. Yeah,
that'd be very exciting. So final question for you. Technology moves rapidly, and it's very difficult for many of our clients, including many technology professionals, to keep up with change. I'm wondering how you at XStep, CTO of XStep, are thinking about the future of technology, and particularly the explosion in large language models and AI in the past year, as well as the prior trends in blockchain technology. I wonder if you can share with us a little bit how your thinking has evolved around maybe these two technologies or others that might be on your radar.
Very good. Actually, XStep Foundation in the last 2 years have been working with Indian Ministry of IT, as well as one of our leading institutions, IIT Madras, where we have funded a center to create language and bring language and AI. Because Indian, as you know, 22 official languages, but hundreds of languages we speak, natural language and voice are going to be the next big push that bound to happen, must happen for a billion people to truly participate in the digital realm, expecting them to speak English or use keyboards or, you know, touch interfaces which are less natural. For example, Indians are one of the largest WhatsApp users, but Indians are also least text typing. They always use WhatsApp to send an audio message because it's a very natural thing for us humans to do voice in local language, right? So we have invested in the last 2 years, all our data sets, tools, language curation, tagging, an entire data set collection tooling, as well as AI models for 22 official Indian languages, voice models, are actually open source right now. And many entrepreneurs are actually embedding now voice models into their app because we are democratizing access to language and voice using AI. And so Extra Foundation has invested significantly in it. And of course, some of the academic institutes are supporting on that journey for us. This is a great example of how you could use AI to push the boundaries of interaction, human-computer interaction itself, right? That second element of Extra Foundation has been working, one of the states collaborating with a large community to create AI-based language learning for small children below middle school. And there's tremendous effort where AI and deep learning technologies are actually used to allow personalized language learning in a private, safe environment. That safe environment is very key because the children want to be confident. They don't want to be ashamed. So government has created brilliant lab environments. And if you are next time, we should show you some of that, where you know people can really play with the computer literally as they learn. Very good early success. It started about 6 months ago. And now they're scaling up across the state and very soon probably scale up across the country as well. So these are two examples of it.
This is very exciting. I mean, you do look at the data sources for ChatGPT, for instance, they're all North American, European, 90 some odd percent English. So the opportunities to kind of expand the data that's available on these models for country context, for local languages, is tremendous and much needed, as well as rethinking ways in which to use this technology, as you say, to kind of reach many of the populations that are illiterate, that are using voice as kind of their first mode for learning and knowledge acquisition. So I think what you're doing is extremely, extremely exciting. Final question, just to wrap up, if you want to share any books or podcasts and a call to action for our listeners, Pramod.
Yeah, so a few things. One, I'll probably share the podcast on DPI versus traditional digitization. There's some very interesting, not all digitization is DPI thinking. DPI thinking really means ecosystem thinking. It means large network effects, incentive aligned, more sustainable than heavy CapEx, traditional digitization projects government take up. So it's good to learn about that. I'll send you some links that you can link it to podcasts, which many people might be wanting to explore. We'll provide some links for the listeners as well on Sunbird, our network thinking, honest.network, https://honest.network. That's our network thinking. That's what Brazil is also doing. India is also doing. Very interesting network effect. And then we have some AI work, which is AIforBharat.org. I'll send that link as well for our language learning. Much of those tools can be used for other languages in other countries as well. It's all open source. And call to action is make the first move, make the first step, and truly spend time to understand why DPI thinking is much less expensive, much actually faster once you understand it, and truly engages the ecosystem for sustainability and evolution. It's totally worth spending time on understanding the basics of the thinking, way of thinking. And that's my call to action, in addition to saying, wherever you are, whichever state you, context you are, or stage you are in, make the move. Don't get into analysis paralysis. You know, keep implementing smaller building blocks that allow the ecosystem to leverage. There is no perfect way to start it or end it. It's a journey. Thank you.
I love it. So in our education strategy paper, the very last recommendation or line in the report is start. So it aligns very well with our conversations with colleagues, clients, and partners as well. So take that first step. Pramod, I can't thank you enough for joining our podcast this week. We'll include all of your references in our podcast notes, and it's been a fascinating discussion, and I look forward to continuing our collaboration around what I think is an incredibly important area to kind of expand access and scale to digital technologies, digital public infrastructure. Thanks so much, Pramod.
Thank you, Bob. A pleasure being here. Thank you, and looking forward to the collaboration. All the best for the listeners as well.